All right, here we go. Hi, everyone. This is Achyuta Bhava from Nightlight Astrology. And today we are going to take a look at Venus's retrograde coming back through the conjunction with Pluto.
All right.
So we are going to revisiting this today from the standpoint of a number of different essays from one of my favorite authors, James Hillman. I've got some excerpts from Dream in the Underworld, Healing Fiction, an essay that he wrote on dreams and dream interpretation. So I'm really excited to dive into this a little bit today. I've titled this talk, Secrets and Visibility in the Underworld. We're going to try to explore Venus and Pluto from a very different place than we've done so far. I have the day off today outside of making content. So I had a lot more spaciousness. I have a lot of spaciousness every morning before I create my content, thanks to my meditation practice. But this morning was sort of extra spacious because there's not that sense of anything that's got to be done later in the day. So I really went deep into thinking about Venus Pluto this morning, and I hope you enjoy this this talk. We're going to try to visit Venus Pluto from, you know, hopefully a lesser known place. At any rate, I'd love to hear where you guys are coming from. I'm doing a live cast this week. It's the holidays. Why not just pop on live and do this? So where are you guys coming from? Let's see here. From Texas. And happy Merry Christmas Eve to everybody who's celebrating. Key West, Atlanta, Georgia, from Navajo Nation. Am I having fun with Pluto opposite my sun? Kind of. Toronto, Greece, Australia, Tucson, Austin, Texas, New Mexico, Tulsa, South Carolina, San Luis Obispo, I hope I said that right, California, Victoria, Texas, Little Rock, Nova Scotia, Guatemala, New York City, Virginia, Belgium, Serbia. Amazing. Very cool. I'm so glad that you're all here. And like I said, we're going to be visiting Venus and Pluto this morning. Before I do that, as always, you guys know that I'm in Kickstarter mode right now. So I'm going to do a little promoting of the Kickstarter before we dive in. Today, this morning, we are at 950 backers with just about almost 7 days left to go. So we finish on New Year's Day pretty early in the morning. So New Year's Eve is sort of your last opportunity to pitch in. I'm going to put the link to the Kickstarter into the chat box. If you haven't pitched in yet, I hope you'll consider donating and supporting this channel in the year ahead. 950 backers, 1,367 is our goal, which means we are just a little bit over 400 backers away from our final goal of the year. And I'm going to put this up on the screen so you can see it. That means you also have literally just, well, hold on just a second. Did that come up? Let's just see if it even appeared. That means that you guys have about 7 days left to take advantage of the half off cost for all of my programs in 2022, which means if you'd like to come study in my Ancient Astrology for the Modern Mystic course that starts in June or November of 2022, or if you want to start in on one of my classes in June or November of 2023 even, you can pick up the discounted tuition through the Kickstarter. It's at the $900 tier. That's 50% off. It's $400 cheaper than even the early bird sale that I run right before the programs start. So really good way of saving. You can bundle the classes together too. You could take year one and year two programs, and that's basically two for the cost of one, even a little cheaper than 50% off. And the savings go up if you bundle, say, year one, year two in horary, or year one, year two in readings and passages, or all four of them. So great deal that I run. You have 7 more days to take advantage of it until that deal is over. And especially for people who are studying in one of my first year programs already, over 50% of the people who take my year one program take my year two program or horary or both. And so It's a great way to save a bunch on something that a lot of people will end up doing in the spring when my year two programs and my horary program start. So other great rewards that you can pick up. So there's a couple of different readings. One of the most popular offerings we have is the year ahead horoscope reading, which is for your sun or rising sign for the year ahead. We also have the astrology of 2022 video, which includes a calendar for the year. And it's the exclusive talk that I'm giving on the astrology of 2022. You'll find me giving a talk on January's astrology of 2022. You won't find me releasing a video on the astrology of the whole year. Have to get that through the Kickstarter. So one of the only things that I make exclusive that I don't offer for free on my channel, just as a way of drumming up some support for the channel in the year ahead. So all these rewards are there. We still need a little over 400 backers to get there. We have just about 7 days left. It'll be 7 days this afternoon. So if you are able to pitch in and contribute, really deeply appreciate your support. It's a lot of love and TLC goes into creating these videos. As you guys know, every day, like right, what did I do today? You know, prior to making this video, what happens? I wake up, I work out my body. First of all, get the body right. Spend almost about 90 minutes in mantra meditation. And typically I will read something for the day, whether it's the Puranas or the Upanishads or the Bhagavad Gita, or usually it's something in the bhakti tradition for me, but often from other traditions as well. After I do all of that, then I sit, having really kind of emptied myself and gotten into my spiritual center the best I can. Then I prepare the talks that I give. And you guys know, sometimes we have fun and we go through the houses. Sometimes we look at archetypal combinations. Sometimes we tell stories from you guys. And other times I do deep dives like this where, you know, I have really taken a deep look at a variety of different texts in my library and prepared a talk. And this happens 5 days a week, year round. So if you enjoy this, ways you can support outside of donating, if you can't afford to pitch in, include liking and subscribing, sharing the videos, clicking on the notification bell so you get notified when there's a live cast happening. All that stuff helps the channel to grow and helps me to continue doing all the cool things that we do. We support a large staff. This is part of how I support my family. We also, because this is successful, all of our programs, whether it's our speaker series programs or the online training courses we have, never price out people who can't afford to take an astrology class. The prerequisite for taking a class from me is that you want to study astrology. And we try the best we can to never let a person's budget get in the way. That happens because you guys are generous and support this channel. So thank you guys. Really appreciate you letting me bang the drum here these last 7 days. Let's see how good we can do coming down the home stretch. All right. Let's turn our attention now to the real-time clock, and we'll take a look at Venus's conjunction with Pluto. So Venus is coming through the conjunction with Pluto today, December 24th, into tomorrow, December 25th. Merry Christmas, everyone. If you're celebrating, you get a nice dose of Venus Pluto on Christmas alongside of a nice dose of Saturn and Uranus. I've joked about, you know, like what kind of Christmas drama can you imagine? It reminds me the potential of this transit reminds me a little bit of that movie, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. If you guys remember that. Oh, all the drama. So Venus conjoins with Pluto today into tomorrow. You're going to be able to feel the energy of Venus's retrograde for a while yet. And Venus moving through Pluto, you'll be able to feel really all the way through, you know, the end of next week. So still a ways to go with this one. Next week, we'll be turning our attention more directly to Jupiter entering Pisces next week, just in time for the new year. So that's the transit we're going to talk about today. And we are going to try to do it from the standpoint of looking at the underworld and what the underworld means and what it doesn't mean. So I want to start by talking about one of the things that I have noticed the most when it comes to Venus-Pluto. How have I seen students, I don't know, social media, you know, everyone's an astrologer now. So you have a lot of people on social media sharing their interpretations of planetary transits. You say, I see that. I say that with such disdain. I don't mind lots of people being astrology. I just like good astrology. And sometimes I feel like there's a little bit of that lacking, but that's my, that's me just being a Scrooge. So Venus Pluto will often be talked about in two ways by astrologers. This is sort of, in my mind, the two banner interpretations of Venus and Pluto that you'll see pretty much everywhere. And I see it in myself, which also means I've forced myself to go deeper. What more is there beside these two interpretations? So the first one, Venus-Pluto will be talked about as a refinement or purification of one's desires or one's desire body. There's a popular phrase, no one knows what it means, but we all say it, right? Whatever your desire body is it being refined? Is it being purified? Are you looking at your desires? Do you have naughty desires? You know, are they unclean? Are they getting you into trouble? Do you need to refine them or purify them? Take this magical elixir and just take a little turmeric. So Venus Pluto, purify the dark stuff. Purify the dark. Do you have a porn problem? You know, it's like Venus Pluto comes around and we're talking about all the bad desires that you shouldn't have, that you should clean or cleanse or purify, that are getting you into trouble somehow. And all of that is fine and dandy. I'm not at all suggesting by, you know, mocking this, I'm just having some fun, but I'm not suggesting that there isn't something to it, right? I can honestly say that in the past couple of weeks, almost every client I've seen has been dealing with some kind of Venus-Pluto desire that, you know, on multiple occasions, I've listened to people talk about marital affairs, or I've listened to people talk about, you know, problems that they're having with, you know, maybe overeating or some way that their desire body is just getting out of control. So it's fair. It's a fair interpretation. The second one is opposite. The opposite interpretation is that, what are you repressing? What do you want really? Like, what do you really desire, but you're holding back from it? It's taboo to want that thing. You know, you feel like it's dirty to want that thing, or you're not being honest with yourself about the thing that you desire. And so the basic translation of these two, this binary, purify your desires or acknowledge your repressed desires, one of the two. It translates into stop doing something that you want but is not good for you, or start doing something that you want but you're holding back from, that you probably should be doing. Right? It's like, okay, fine, we get it, but isn't there anything more? There's nothing more. You're telling me that the god of the underworld and Venus, the goddess, have nothing to say other than stop eating cheeseburgers or just let yourself have a cheeseburger? You know what I mean? So this was where I started this morning. When I started making this talk, I thought to myself, okay, what can we say about Venus Pluto that goes beyond, I want frosting, you know, or and I'm just going to let myself have it, or I shouldn't want frosting because it's dirty and it's making me bad. So what else is there? That's where I started this morning. And I asked the I Ching, and I pulled out a lot of books, and I sat and I thought about it for a long time. And then I wrote this talk. I started by asking the question, what more is there? And then I started realizing something. The first thing that I started realizing was that we need to learn how to listen to Pluto. And we need to learn in general how to listen to symbols in a way, in any other way than the hermeneutic approach. The hermeneutic approach being symbols, decode into psychological instructions or imperatives that I can go and do, that I can go and accomplish, because I'm a work in progress and I need to know what I need to do, you know, to get better. So I'm laughing because it's so true that we do this as astrologers all the time. I'm like, these astrologers out there who don't have good astrology, but the whole, actually it's comic, the real comedy of it is the whole reason for this is I was like, man, I don't feel like I've said anything other than this too. Throw me right into the junk bin. Pluto Hades literally means the invisible one, right? In the invisible one. What does it mean when the goddess conjoins through her retrograde motion with the invisible one? That's a more interesting question to me than Venus equals desire. Pluto equals unconscious repression. Unconscious repression of desire. You should go and deal with that. Something doesn't feel right about something. Feels to me like I'm forgetting Pluto in all of this. I'm forgetting Venus in all of this as living beings that have something to say or that have some dimensionality outside of my, you know, just moving them along the conveyor belt line of self-help instructions for my next day or week of life. I just get sick of things like this. Mostly, not that I don't need those instructions too, and not that that hermeneutic maneuver isn't there. Like I said, you can interpret the symbols this way. And a lot of times it really works, like it's applicable. I'm not saying it isn't, but I just get sick of it because it feels like in some ways, especially because my life is sort of like a conveyor belt of astrological content, and I don't want it to turn into that all the time. So I have to reapproach the symbols constantly and be like, what are you saying? Who are you really? You know? Like, what do you actually want to say? Well, I started thinking about it. Well, Hades is the invisible one. He's said to rule over the dead, and yet the dead live in another world. That's interesting that the dead live in an underworld, and Pluto is invisible, not seen, and yet rules over a land in which the unseen dead people live. And the underworld is also in Greek myth right here. We just can't see it. Isn't that interesting? So what does it mean when the goddess Venus gets into this unseen, invisible realm of the living dead? It's someplace that's here, but we can't see it. Okay, so I want to read you guys a few things. These come from essays written by James Hillman. One of my favorite books of all time is called The Dream and the Underworld. I don't know if you guys can see it. The Dream and the Underworld. And in this book, Hillman gives like an anatomy of the underworld in a way, but it's not, anatomy isn't the right word. It's like a poetic topology or something like that. He starts off at the very beginning of the book and he writes this: the remainder of this essay meets these Freudian and Jungian objections, which can be summarily condensed into one statement. The dream requires translation into waking language, either to extend waking consciousness's domain or to serve nature's demands for the more broadened and balanced qualities of consciousness. In developing my thesis further, I shall follow Freud and Jung both, but not only. Freud, by insisting that the dream has nothing to do with the waking world, but is the psyche itself speaking to itself in its own language. And Jung, by insisting that the ego requires adjustment to the night world. I shall not be following them in bringing the dream into the day world in any other form than its own, implying that the dream may not be envisaged either as a message to be deciphered for the day world or as a compensation to it. By day world and daylight, I do not mean the daily world. I mean rather the literal view of any world where things seem as they appear, where we have not seen through into their darkness, their deadly nightshade. It is this day world style of thinking, literal realities, natural comparisons, contrary opposites, processional steps that must be set aside in order to pursue the dream into its home territory. There, thinking moves in images, resemblances, correspondences. To go in this direction, we must sever the link with the day world, forgoing all ideas that originate there, translation, reclamation, compensation. We must go over the bridge and let it fall behind us. And if it will not fall, then let it burn. So think about this from the standpoint of what we often say about Venus and Pluto. What does it, what does Venus and Pluto mean? Well, I will arrest its meaning. I will thieve something from this combination to be given to my conscious efforts to become more heroically virtuous, moral, and spiritual, right? And in doing so, I leave behind the actual shadowy, dreamy-like terrain of working with symbols, of speaking to them, of getting to know gods and daimons. I'm leaving all that behind because I've decided, Venus and Pluto, stop desiring or wanting the bad cookie. Or start allowing yourself to have the cookie. But what's happened to Venus and Pluto? What's happened to them? They have been taken from the subterranean, from the dream world, from the underworld, from the place where the dead are living, from the place where the gods move about, from those spaces the ancients called the metacosmios, world in between worlds, liminal spaces where gods and omens and oracles dwell. They come to inhabit the bird or animal on your walk or the planets in the sky, moving in their patterns. They suggest something. They move in your soul and speak to you. They keep you curious. You get to know these presences. No. We so quickly, don't we? We move past that and we say, but what does it mean for me and my progression as a, you know, developing, perfecting being, right? So that we do this all the time. I do this all the time. And in doing so, we are always trying to take the gods and translate them into some kind of literal instruction for our literal issues in the literal world. Thank God Venus Pluto appeared, because now I know the dirty bad thing that I shouldn't be doing anymore, or thinking or feeling or wanting. Or again, in the opposite direction, I'm not going to repress it anymore, right? And there's something we lose in this. So he goes on. Actually, I'm going to switch to this one first. I want to read you guys a short essay. Today it's like James Hillman reading hour. I'm going to read you guys a short essay called "A Snake is Not a Symbol." I've actually read this before a couple of years ago. This is to the same point. Often I begin a workshop on animal images with the snake. The snake works like a charm, freeing people of their insidious notions of snake symbolism and therefore of animal symbolism in general. The question I ask sounds like this: how do you understand a snake image? What does a snake mean? What's your interpretation? I have assembled and condensed the replies. Number one, the snake is renewal and rebirth because it sheds its skin. Two, a snake represents the negative mother, because it wraps around, smothers, won't let you go, and swallows whole. Number three, it is the animal embodiment of evil. It is sly, shifty, sinister, fork-tongued, and it is cursed by God to slide on its belly because of what it did to Eve and Adam. The book of Revelation says that the serpent is the devil himself. Number four, it's a feminine symbol, having a sympathetic relation with Eve and the goddesses in Crete, India, Africa, and elsewhere. Number five, the snake is a phallus because it stiffens, erects its head, and ejects fluid from its tip. Besides, it penetrates crevices. Number six, it represents the material earth world and as such is a universal enemy of the spirit. Birds flight in nature and heroes fight it in culture. The snake is a healer. Birds fight it in nature and heroes fight it in culture. The snake is a healer. It is a medicine and we still see it in the signs of pharmacies. It was kept in the healing temples of Asclepius in Greece, and a snake dream was the god himself coming to cure. 8, it is a guardian of holy and wise men. Even the New Testament says serpents are wise. 9, the snake brings fertility, for it is found by wells and springs and represents the cool, moist element. 10, a snake is death because of its poison and the instant anxiety it arouses. 11, it is the inmost truth of the body, like the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, or the serpent power of Kundalini yoga. That's why the sophisticated folk medicine among Native Americans, South Asians, Chinese, and Africans, for instance, rely on parts of the snake for remedies. 12, the snake is the symbol for the unconscious psyche, particularly the introverting libido, the inward turning energy that goes back and down and in. Its seduction draws us into darkness and deeps. It is always a both, creative, destructive, male, female, poisonous and healing, dry, moist, spiritual, material, and many other irreconcilable opposites, like the figure of Mercurius. This 12th interpretation of the snake takes all the other 11 and turns them into steps in a program in which the snake is finally explained by the final step. The snake is the unconscious psyche. What has really been said by this last term that is not better said by the image itself? Its fascinating flickering tongue, its rattle or hiss and quick strike, its reticulated glistening skin, its coil and sidewinding, the panic rising on sudden sight of it. Why must we exchange the living image for an interpretive concept? Are interpretations really psychological defenses against the presence of a god? Remember, most of the Greek gods, goddesses, and heroes had a snake form: Zeus, Dionysus, Demeter, Athene, Hercules, Hermes, Hades, even Apollo. Is our terror of the snake the appropriate response of a mortal to an immortal? For instance, a black snake comes in a dream, a great big black snake, and you can spend a whole hour of therapy with this black snake, talking about the devouring mother, talking about anxiety, about repressed sexuality, and all the other interpretive moves that we therapists make. But what remains after all the symbolic understanding is what that snake is doing. This crawling, huge black snake that's sliding into your life. The moment you've caught the snake in an interpretation, you have lost the snake. You've stopped its living movement. Then the person leaves the therapeutic hour with a concept about my repressed sexuality or my cold black passions or my mother, and it is no longer with the snake. The interpretation settles the emotional quivering and mental uncertainty that came with the snake. In fact, the snake is no longer necessary. It has been successfully banished by interpretation. You, the dreamer, don't need the snake anymore. And you then form the habit of not needing dreams anymore either once they have been interpreted. Meaning replaces image. Animal disappears into the human mind. There are various ways of keeping the snake around. It can be imagined as a felt presence and talked with. It may need to be fed and housed, painted and modeled. It can be honored by attention, like recalling it several times during the day. By doing something for it, a physical gesture, lighting a candle, buying an amulet, discovering its name. It can be brought closer by visualizing it, sensing its skin, its strength. Now imagination replaces meaning and the human mind gives itself over to the animal presence. This is the psychological and imaginative work of animating the image, giving a life soul back to the snake that may have been removed from it by your desire to understand it. The snake may have no objection to being understood. It may be pleased with your turning to herpetology books about snakes, by your visit to a zoo to watch them, by your reading of ancient serpent mysteries. But whatever you do, consult with the snake first so that you do not insult it by following your own plan without recognizing its arrival in your life. Its arrival is a summons to divert your intentions from yourself, at least partially, and toward it. Animating the image, that is the task today. No longer is it a question of symbolic contents of dreams. Over 100 years ago, Freud brought us back to the old traditions of symbolism and the old traditions of dream meanings. Then Jung explored these symbolisms and meanings even more widely and deeply. But then both Freud and Jung made a move that we no longer want to repeat. They both translated the images of animals into crystallized symbolic meanings. They didn't let what appeared express itself enough, but moved towards satisfying the rationalizing and often frightened day-world mind. This means that. Even Jung's method of active imagination, which does animate the image, is less for the sake of the animal's soul than for yours, the dreamer's. Pinned and wriggling on the wall, said T.S. Eliot about the modern mind's mode of operation. Eliot's image suggests that the psyche's butterfly unable to wing its way beyond diagnostic labels and interpretive meanings. Once you've translated the great snake into your omnipotence fantasy or penis envy, or you've translated as the mother symbol, the great mother, then you no longer need the image, and you let the image only say one thing in two words, great mother. Then it disappears. You don't want that black snake, really, not anymore. You want to work on your mother complex, your personality, and so on. This leaves the soul unanimated, that is, unalive. The images are not walking around on their own legs. They've been turned into meanings. Now let's try to leave meaning and the search for meaning and the meaning of life so as to stick with the animal image. In our eagerness for conceptual meanings, we ignore the actual beast. We are no longer astounded by its facts or wonder over its presence, that, for instance, a snake dislocates its jaw to swallow an animal larger than itself, that its digestive system works without chewing, without teeth or gizzard or cud, like a rhythmic peristalsis that squeezes its meal against the snake's backbones, crushing its prey into a digestible pulp, or, for instance, the fact that its discarded skin, after shedding, appears to go on shedding. Lives without meaning hunger for meanings, and psychologists feed the hungry with the living presence of animals. Patients as carnivores, devouring the flesh of their dream animals to satisfy their gluttony for knowledge. Or have we psychologists become taxidermists, disemboweling the snake, stuffing it with concepts, and preserving it as a carefully fixed meaning? So, let's go back. Venus and Pluto. Venus and Pluto. There's something you're doing that's not really good. It's a bad, naughty desire. It's a secret something that you ought to purge and cleanse and purify. That's what Venus and Pluto, these gods in the form of massive planets moving through space, that's what they mean. Just that. Just for you, so you can get on with the process of becoming better, right? Or, on the other hand, there's something you're not letting yourself do. You're repressing a desire. And Venus and Pluto, they have no other meaning other than to help you recognize that you should just go eat that cookie, smash your face into the frosting, just love yourself, right? So Hillman really challenges us. And he says, you know what's forgotten in all of that? Venus and Pluto. What's forgotten in all of that is a living relationship with gods. What's missing in that is that gods are not just here as symbols to be combined and adjectives to be extracted into simple self-help steps to be taken. The whole purpose of doing astrology is also to move into a symbolic erotics. We want the symbols to be like presences, gods, real beings, just like animals and dreams should be more than just something that we interpret and strip away of their actual presence. I remember one time when I was reading this book, I had a dream about a toucan that was came to me in a dream and was talking to me. It was a bizarre image, a toucan. I don't know why I would be thinking about a toucan. And upon reading this, I resisted the urge to interpret what the toucan meant. Ted Andrews' Animal Speaks. Where is it? Give it to me right now. What does Ted say about toucans? Aha, that's what it means. Now I can take that from the unconscious. I aptly interpreted its meaning, and now I can go and become a better person because I've received the message from the toucan, which honestly is a lot of the, I mean, I honestly, until I really started deeply studying James Hillman, I think it would have been more common for me to do something like that. So instead, I purchased a statue of a toucan that I found on Amazon, and I put it near my bed. And every night I would talk to it before I went to sleep. And do you know what happened? that toucan appeared in my life in my dreams for about a year until it just disappeared again. And it said a lot of meaningful things, and it appeared in a lot of different ways, and it had a lot to say. But what I remember more than anything that it ever said or told me to do or messages it gave me was the fact that I established a relationship with a freaking toucan in the dream space. Like, and to me, that changed my life. And I highly recommend, when people are studying astrology, I say this to all of my students, that you first and foremost understand astrology as a form of divination, not some kind of astro logos, purely in the realm of Hermes. These are just moving archetypes in the sky, meant to be uncoded, decoded, you know, to make the unconscious conscious, right? All of that. No, these are gods, right? And your ability to be a good reader, if you're going to read charts for people, is tantamount to your ability to have good relationships with these presences, which, yes, Hermes speaks on behalf of all of the gods. Hermes is an interlocutor. Hermes is the god of astrology, because part of astrology is interpreting the messages of the gods, their omens, their warnings, their prognostications, their rulership over the process of fate. But you can't do it unless you have a relationship with the gods, unless you have some kind of living connection with them, which goes beyond how able you are to interpret their meanings. It's not, because if you just interpret their meanings, they will stop giving their meanings to you, or you'll start interpreting them in ways that are not appropriate, because they see that you're objectifying them, because they're gods, right? Because they're beings. So what appears like a system moving in the sky that's just purely logical and rational and should be able to be decoded, just like it's Morse code. It's just a system that should be able to be decoded according to a logic, is merely the syntax, diction, and grammar of a language that living beings called gods, daimons, etc., use to speak to us as diviners who are interpreting astrology or bringing its presence into our everyday life. So that's first and foremost. And I'm saying this as we're trying to do today is, like, look at how easy it is to fall into that mode. I've done it. I still do it regularly. It's easy to keep falling back into that mode, especially when you're someone like me who makes content every day and you want to try to give people some practical instructions for life. You can't sit and take everyone into deep reveries about the presence of the gods every day. It's hard. It's not easy to evoke that state of relationship. But that is why you hear me hammering on about why I think my YouTube channel is valuable. And I say it's because of all the time I spend previous to making the content. The reason that I feel that it's valuable to say that is because, and the more you start studying astrology, the more you realize this exact truth, which is that you have to establish relationships with these symbols. There's a symbolic eroticism that has to develop in your own psyche. This is true whether you're someone like me who makes content year round, or someone who just loves astrology, or someone who's going to read charts for people or teach it to other people or whatever. No relationship with these presences means that over time, you will not get they will not yield their deepest secrets, teachings, meanings, prognostications. They won't be your friends. They won't hang out. They won't show up in your dreams. They won't give you that little light that comes on in a session when you're reading for someone. Don't have to, like, get into some kind of super awe and reverence mode either, where you're singing Orphic hymns to Venus every morning and ringing a bell like you're playing a Dungeons and Dragons game either. You know, it's like, just be yourself. But you have to establish a relationship with them. Back to dream in the underworld. Hillman writes this: entering the underworld, this is Pluto's domain, refers to a transition from the material to the psychical point of view. Three dimensions become two as the perspective of nature, flesh, and matter fall away, leaving an existence of immaterial, mirror-like images, eidola. We are in the land of soul. As Nielsen says, eidolon signifies simply image and always keeps the sense. For the Greeks, the soul was an image. We have to be careful about the words we use for describing these eidola. they are not substantial. And so we may not use our convenient substantializing language. We may not just say they are this or that, or say that existence in the underworld is so and so. We may speak of Eidola only as they seem, appear to be, or what they liken unto. Our statements must be prefixed by an as if that little word is the coin we offer Charon for taking us across the separating waters between two kinds of speech. The dead speak differently. They whisper. Their talk has lost its positive substance, its natural certainty. We must lean in very close to hear this kind of speech. Eidola may be distinguished from icons, which are better compared with pictorial copies, visible things out there that we can touch, even make. The word Eidolon relates with Hades himself, Adonis, and with Eidos, ideational forms and shapes, the ideas that form and shape life, but are so buried in it that we only see them when pulled out in abstractions. So we are speaking of images that are at the same time invisible. Remember, Hades, invisible. We are inside the imaginative mind. Another way of putting this underworld would be to stress the shadowy or shade aspect. Skia was another word the Greek imagination used for underworld figures. The persons there are shades. So we must imagine a world without light in which shadows move. Yet how can we speak about shadows in the dark? Since for upper world consciousness, shadows result only from physical things blocking the light. How can there be shadows in the dark? The problem is very much like trying to sense the movement of one's own shadow, trying to catch a glimmer of the shape behind the scenes, to tune in to what else is going on in what seems to be a natural action or simple conversation is precisely trying to see shadows in the dark. It is to notice the fantasy in the moment, to witness the psyche's shadow play in our unconscious daily living. Consciousness of this sort is reflective, watching not just the physical reality in front of the eyeballs and by means of them, but seeing into the flickering patterns within that physical reality and within the eyes themselves. It is a perception of perception. Or as Jung said about images, they are the self-perception of instinct. Our blind instinctual life may be self-reflected by means of imagining, not after or before events in the closet of introspection, but as an eye or ear that catches the image of the event while it occurs. So again, entering the underworld is like entering the mode of reflection, mirroring, which suggests that we may enter the underworld by means of reflection, by reflective means, pausing, pondering, a change of pace, voice, or a glance, dropping levels. Such reflection is less willed and directed, is less determinedly introspective, like a heroic descent into the underworld to see what's going on there. Let us rather imagine it to be more hermetic, a cocked ear, a sideways look, a suspicious fisheye, or intuitional feeling and thoughts that appear in the midst of life and twist life into psyche. There's one last little small excerpt I'm going to read you from an essay that a book that Hillman wrote called Healing Fiction. My point here is not that Hermes is the wrong god for analysis. He's talking now about psychoanalysis. My point is that once he has been invited in, then we better know what we might expect. He is himself a healing fiction, a god. And Hermes heals by convincing us of that fiction of interpretation, making symbols work out constructively for us so that the interpreter hits just on the word which opens the way. But if Hermes is to function properly as guide of souls, we must have some material for him to turn into a message. No dreams, no symbols, no therapeutic insights. There must be something to move across the threshold and exchange or translate into an insight. He appears in the interpretive act. His gift is the insight. One recognizes where he has been by the mound of stones erected to mark his intervention. Aha, this is what it means. So Hermes is a part of our life. Hermes will eventually approach Venus and Pluto and conjoin with the two of them. And Hermes plays a role in our everyday lives as astrologers. Astrology was considered to be the science of Hermes, a god of interpretation. But Hermes is a god that has relationships with all the other gods and is able to somehow traverse back and forth from the shadowy realm, the realm of the living dead, the places of invisibility, and the realm of the gods themselves, and into our world to bring messages that somehow make sense. So it's not to say that Venus and Pluto don't literally mean at times that you should put the cake down or maybe take the cake up, depending on if you have gone bananas or if you are repressed. You know what I mean? But it's also crucial to realize that becoming a Hermetic astrologer means to become like Hermes, which isn't to just receive his messages and go and do what we will with them, but to get to know the gods and to become like Hermes as a friend of the gods, bearing relationships with the gods, which essentially you could say, if you want to take it out of literal relationships with the gods, at the very least means that we need to develop some sense of symbolic eroticism in our life, which means we get to know the symbols and we crave hearing them speak and appear in all of the different ways that we do, with our sideways glances and our sense of sudden recognition. Oh, there's a god among me. There's a symbol speaking. That we develop that is just as important, that we develop a love for just that moment and that those flickering spaces and the presence of the gods, the feeling that the gods are near, as much as we develop the ability to interpret whatever it is that they might have to say. Symbolic eroticism. There's Venus, Pluto. There's just a meta way of thinking about Venus and Pluto. Just sitting down this morning and thinking, here I've been interpreting Venus, Pluto. Here I see lots of astrologers right now just interpreting Venus, Pluto. But where are Venus and Pluto? What? There's something we're missing here. And so I sat with it, and all of these images and thoughts and passages came to mind. And what did they do? What I love about James Hillman more than anything is that they take me to the gods. They take me to the snake, to the dream, to the goddess, to Hades, to the underworld, to Hermes. Now I can feel them. Now they're real to me. And that's what we want more than anything. We're not really, what is the goal of life? To take all these symbols and to progress to level 10 spiritually? To evolve through your north node in 30 more lifetimes until you reach the top rung, and God's like, good job. You made it all the way through the north and south node maze. That was a tough one. Glad you figured it out. No, it's absurd. What can we imagine that actually the goal of life is relationship? That reality is a relational being just inviting us to explore infinite intimacy through curiosity, through learning, through experience, that intimacy, relational curiosity is the goal itself, a worthy goal? Does it need to be anything more than that? So symbolic eroticism, there's Venus, Pluto. Can we just be curious and listen to the different presences that are there in the psyche, in the environment, in things that speak or suddenly turn and catch our attention somehow? And we know that there's the dead are with us. By the dead, we mean the living that are invisible. The allowing of symbols. So lessons, takeaways. Let's let Hermes speak now. Let symbols speak. Just let them speak. Try to work that into your relationship with astrology. The allowing of symbols to speak without any kind of interpretation is how the symbolic eye develops, because you're developing intimacy with these presences. And the symbolic eye is the one who hears and sees spirits, daimons, gods moving invisibly. Here's a really good one. When interpretations rise up, keep them secret, or keep a few secret, especially if you're someone who works with symbols regularly. Don't rush toward the Ted Andrews Animal Speaks book or the Dream Dictionary or whatever. And instead, when something speaks, when something stands out, try to see if you can further the relationship. If how annoying is it like this? Sherry messaged me on Facebook. I'm just making this up. Sherry messaged me on Facebook. What does it mean? Oh my God, does it mean Sherry likes me? Sherry, did you message me on Facebook because you like me? Right? And if you're anything like any girl I ever dated when I was 17, if I ever did that, it's like gone. No chance. You know, it's like, oh, come on. You know, like what? You've just squashed the connection by trying to interpret its meaning. Why don't you just say, hey, you know, like Sherry contacts you on Facebook, or if Dave reaches out to you, you know, instead of being like, what does this mean? What are your intentions, Dave? You know, just go, hi, what's up? See what happens. So when interpretations rise, keep them secret. When symbols speak, keep them secret, because we know that secrets are symptomatic of the soul. The soul is coming forth to speak when secrets start appearing. Try placing the statue of the toucan next to your bed. Do you know what I mean? And again, don't, I would say, avoid the D&D enactment. Now I'm going to have a relationship with the gods. I've got my cloak on. I've drawn my sacred geometry on the altar. And now I'm chanting to Isis, or, you know, it's like, don't, if that's your thing, if that's naturally you, if you were just a warlock from birth, then fine, you know, but like, just be yourself. You can do this wearing a hoodie. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? So only when we've developed these qualities, this sacred uncertainty, this respect for the dead, the depths, the underworld, this attunement to invisibility, do things like Venus and Pluto really have a chance to speak to us. So I dare you today, for the next few days, to see if you can develop some kind, if you can feel Venus and Pluto and just start reaching out. See how that changes the dynamic of what they have to say compared to what the astrologer has to say about what they have to say, which really breaks down, it appears everywhere, into eat more cake or don't eat the cake. So messages are delivered in ways that keep secrets even while revealing wisdom. That is the essence of occultism for thousands of years. Mercury can't work as a hermeneutic messenger when we have not learned how to know the invisible Mercury, the cloaked, helmeted Mercury that was given the gift of invisibility by Hades. Invisible psychopomp of the underworld. See, I really am a warlock. I just still dress like I want to be part of the Backstreet Boys. So, oh my gosh, this has been fun today. Consider what I find here stays quiet. What I hear, sense, see, I will stay curious about. I will not come to immediate conclusions about. This presence is attractive to me, and I want it to stay around more, be around a little bit more. So I thought about this last night. You might be saying, you know, all of this dead, all of the dead, what are you doing? And I will say this. I went last night in Minneapolis. There's a theater called the Guthrie. I went to the Guthrie last night with my mom and her partner and Ashley, and we saw A Christmas Carol. And one of the things, I love that play so much. I've seen the play probably 7 or 8 times in my life now. It's been a tradition for Ashley and I to go and see, we like The Christmas Carol, and we like to go see some performance of The Nutcracker if we can find it around the holidays. But I love A Christmas Carol in particular, because one of the things that I love about that story is that you could easily say, oh, it's a Christian story, you know, about redemption and kindness and compassion and changing your ways and becoming the better person. But you know what I think it's a story about? Ghosts. That's why I liked it as a kid. That's why I like it today. It's a story about spirits. And it's a story about the way in which this guy changes his ways, not to me, just because there's all of these lessons that he's shown by spirits, or all this heavy stuff or consequences that he's shown by spirits, but also because he cultivates relationships with spirits. And that to me is one of the most interesting symbols of Christmas time. It always has been, that there is some way in which, if we get to know the dead, if we get to know the presence of these living spirits, we start to see them in the time-bound world of Saturn. You know, it's interesting that Jacob Marley in the Christmas Carol, he was born, he died on Christmas Eve, and then 7 years later, a quarter of the Saturn cycle, Scrooge finds himself on Christmas Eve. And did you know that the date on his gravestone marks him as an Aquarius, a Saturn-ruled sign? It's an interesting thing to note. 7 years later, a Saturn number, on the same Christmas Eve that Jacob Marley died, he's visited by Jacob Marley, the dead. And then he's visited by spirits all throughout the night in a dream state. This is how most of us really change. Most of us really transform, whether it's something simple or something profound, because of dream in the underworld, because of dreams and spirits, because of the presence of the invisible world. That's why we really love astrology, right? That's the thing that draws us in over and over again. And I was thinking, what more is there to this Venus-Pluto dynamic? And I'll just end by saying this. This is my attempt this morning to just tell Venus and Pluto myself through giving this talk, hey, I've felt you around lately. And sorry if I've just been interpreting you, sort of what I do for a living every day. But last night when I was watching those spirits on that stage in the theater and the costumes, I was just reminded, this is really what people need from symbols. They need it to be theatrical. They need spirits, gods, dreams, and not just as something to be interpreted, but as something that we see that, we feel that, and it just awakens within us this imaginal dimension of life, which is where any real, ongoing, meaningful hermeneutic interpretation comes from. So I hope that you find this Christmas spirit in yourself, whatever that may be, aside from any of the religious connotations of the holiday. I hope you find spirits in you. And I hope that they speak to you, that you develop a relationship with them. And then if some good instructions come of it, so be it. To me, that's the maybe some of the eroticism and symbolic artfulness that Venus-Pluto speaks to. So thank you guys so much for listening today. I hope you guys enjoy this. I hope you guys have a very Merry Christmas if you're celebrating. We'll be also bringing in the new year together next week. Don't forget, I still need your help with the Kickstarter. We have about a little over, just a little over 400 more backers that we need prior to the new year to meet our goal for this year. So pitch in if you haven't yet. The link will be in the comments section of this video, in the description of this video. I put in the chat, in the live stream chat box a few times. Pick up tuition. Come to one of my programs. Let's hang out and study astrology together next year. Combine them together. Pick up a reading. Appreciate all the love and support you guys have given already. Thank you, everyone. And we will see you guys next.